We're often given the impression today that science has somehow disproved the existence of God or that the Christian faith is opposed to modern science. But many scholars note that modern science was actually born in a Christian milieu, not despite the Christian faith, but actually because of it. Author and Professor Mike Keyes, Dr. Mike Keyes of the Discovery Institute, joins us now to discuss the not-so-missing link between Christianity and the development of modern science, despite what the Richard Dawkins types have to say. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and Dr. Mike Keyes joins us now. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jerry, for having me on the show.
And by the way, I know you and I have had a discussion about this in the past. There was a book you had written. If you want to mention that book real fast and what the thesis was, I believe it's related to this overall topic of the link between Christianity and science.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Unbelievable, Seven Myths About the History and Future of Science and Religion. And after teaching science to college students for a quarter century, I had noted many times how these stories get repeated over and over about Christianity being an impediment to the growth of science. And my own studies showed that it often contributed to the science-friendly ideas that are in the background of science that help sort of to motivate and guide science. So I wrote a book about it.
All right. Well, let's start with Galileo, because I'm sure the case of Galileo is often brought up as an example of, oh, the church, you know, tried to squash science and, you know, when, because it supposedly threatened the Bible.
Right. Yes. That is an often go-to place for the attempt to make that case. Now, Galileo himself considered himself a Christian believer and member of the Catholic Church, he was, and he thought that his work could be shown to be compatible with Scripture. But what he found through his newly fashioned telescope was something actually quite remarkable for that time, talking the 17th century. Venus goes through phases, sort of like the moon does, like crescent shape and gibbous shape, which is almost full, like full moon. Now, before the invention of the telescope, people had no way of knowing that. So he peered into the sky at nighttime and saw this and noted that the Earth-centered view with the sun going around the Earth had no way of dealing with this observation in the traditional way that had been put forward by ancient astronomers. And so he suggested that the Copernican view, that Earth goes around the sun and that Venus also goes around the sun in a smaller orbit, so that as we look from Earth to see Venus, sometimes Venus is on the opposite side of the sun as from where we are, and so we can see Venus as like gibbous or almost full phase, like the moon. And that's impossible given the traditional Ptolemaic or ancient Greek view of the cosmos, where Earth was at the center and at rest. So he did show that the ancient view couldn't make sense of this, but the Catholic Inquisition, and I'm not trying to defend the Inquisition itself, because it was guilty of overreach in many instances, but the leading inquisitor, Cardinal Bellarmine, actually correctly showed that Galileo had not proven that the Earth moved, because there was a third view available at the time besides the Copernican view and the Ptolemaic or the Earth-centered view. It was called the Tychonic view, which is kind of a hybrid between the two. And according to that view, Earth is still at rest in the center. Sun goes around the Earth, but the Sun also carries around it the orbit of Venus. And so you could get all the phases of Venus that we see with a telescope. So that's one area where the story of Galileo is oversimplified to make it sound like Galileo represented science and the Catholic Church represented Christianity, opposing science, when in fact there were Jesuit astronomers in Rome who championed this third option, this Tychonic view, and so could make sense of the phases of Venus just as well as Galileo did. So Galileo failed to prove his case at the time. It wasn't until the time of Newton that we could prove the Earth moved. And by then, the Catholic Church was able to come to align itself with the new discovery. So it really wasn't a case of science versus religion. It was really just growth pains in science, just making new discoveries to the telescope, and growth pains in theology of how do you go about interpreting the Bible when it comes to its mention of natural phenomena. And regarding the latter, you know, when the Bible talks about sunrise and sunset, even Copernicus used those terms, sunrise and sunset. They're simply phenomenological or observation-based terms. You're not committing yourself to what's actually moving or what's at rest. Just like today, when Jerry, when you and I use the terms sunrise and sunset, we're not advocating a particular cosmology. It's just a common way of referring to the way things appear. So things like, I can make other distinctions besides the ones I've made, but these help show it wasn't a simplistic warfare story of science versus Christianity. It was much more complicated and interesting story than that.
And we should, you've already made the point that Galileo did believe in the Bible and so forth. So it boils down to it was a difference of their understanding of the Bible. Now, how did science in some ways benefit from a Christian worldview? And I will say this. You mentioned Kepler. Kepler used a phrase that scientists are, in effect, quote unquote, keeping or thinking God's thoughts after him. And he said something to the effect that we astronomers are priests of the Most High God. Their idea was, he was thinking that, wow, God has made this universe, and this is what other scientists thought as well. God has made this universe, and we scientists are in effect just trying to catalog and understand the rules and the laws of nature that God has put and impressed upon his own creation. Something to that effect. Would you think that's a fair assessment of the situation?
It is. And let me give a little more detail to it to flesh out the argument. So, yeah, Kepler was a devout Christian. He happened to be Lutheran. And he discovered what are now called the three laws of planetary motion. Law one is that planets move in elliptical orbits, not circular orbits. And the other two laws give details as to how the planets move in elliptical orbits around the sun. Kepler contrasted his view of science from Aristotle, the ancient pagan philosopher who had some very insightful things about nature to say, but Kepler pointed out that Aristotle did not believe that the world had been created. And here's a quote from Kepler, and thus Aristotle could not recognize the mathematical design plans for the material world, because without an architect, there is no such power in mathematics to make anything material. In other words, mathematics, Kepler was saying, is passive. It's a quantitative descriptive discipline, and math equations can't do anything, but a active, powerful, intelligent agent, God, can take mathematical ideas from his mind and create a world that's governed by physical laws that operate by the regularities expressed in mathematics. And Kepler was thereby distinguishing his theology of nature from Aristotle's, saying that, I have a theology that allows me to think more productively in a scientific way, that allowed him to discover these three laws of planetary motion. And Kepler even further said that this way of thinking about nature, of God having selected mathematical rules to govern the physical world, he said it's available to us as Christians because we believe that God created the world according to weight, measure, and number. That is in accordance with ideas co-eternal with him. So in other words, Kepler was saying mathematics has eternally existed in the mind of God. It's not something other than God or some other principle totally separate from God, but mathematics is part of the eternal mental content of the mind of God. And he selected some of these beautiful mathematical relationships to instantiate into the physical world. And he did so freely. He didn't have to make a world with exactly an inverse square law for gravity or which Newton later discovered, he had a lot of options as to how he could make the world. And so that means we got to go out and test multiple possible mathematical principles that might be the key to certain physical laws. And he actually tested multiple shapes besides the elliptical shape. The circular shape clearly had failed, given the new data that he had inherited from a previous employer that he had worked for, a guy named Tycho Brahe. But he also tested other shapes besides the ellipse, and he eventually found that the best correlation between planetary positions as viewed from Earth and possible orbital paths in space was the elliptical shape. And so his Christian commitments helped him to be a more productive scientist. And they weren't just incidental, not just window dressing, but were very important for the way he thought that proved so productive for science.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes left. What other examples do you want to give of, you know, Christianity helping to give birth to modern science?
Well, Christians believed, as Jews, that Christians built upon Jewish ideas that God made us in his image so we can know the world, but we're fallen and we're finite. And so that balance between optimism, because we're made in God's image, and humility, because we're fallen, helped for scientists to both bravely go out and test their ideas, but to realize that they might make mistakes and they have to subject their work to peer review and keep honing it down. Also, the Christian idea that the universe is a comprehensible object, that the mind of God made it, and so therefore humans made in God's image can also, to some degree, although imperfectly, grasp some things about the world. And finally, the idea of the unity of heaven and earth. For example, Psalm 102 says that the heavens are the work of God's hands and that they will perish like a piece of clothing does. Well, ancient scientists like Aristotle said the heavens are never change except for circular motion, that things don't fall apart up there in the heavens. The Bible indicated otherwise, and science finally caught up with that and was able to discover things like supernovae, you know, where a star explodes, and other changes in the heavens. So science and scripture have been friends for a very long time, Jerry.
Okay, we have about 1 minute left. What about the idea that the earth has a beginning, that life has a beginning, you know, as opposed to the idea that, you know, well, you know, in the beginning was hydrogen and it always existed?
Yeah, well, the earth sciences, which is tracing the history of Earth, and the cosmological study of the history of the universe have pointed to that Earth had a beginning and that the universe as a whole had a beginning. The cosmic beginning is particularly theistic friendly because it points to a beginning that's beyond space, time, and matter. Ever since 20th century cosmology, we've seen a lot of evidence that the universe hasn't always existed, but there was a singularity, a point of beginning that where as you go backward in time, the laws of physics break down and we have the origin of space, time, and matter. That points to a cause that is beyond space, time, and matter, which is very, very accurate to what the Bible describes about God as being essentially spiritual being, and yet a being that could enter our world through Jesus Christ, and thus we could know him.
Wow. Dr. Mike Keyes, discovery.org for more information. Thank you so much for being with us. And by the way, Keyes is spelled K-E-A-S. All the best. Thank you now.
Thanks, Jerry.